Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode number 321, recorded Friday, November 10th, 2017. Leslie Berlin, Troublemakers. Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. And by Eddie Bauer. This winter, don't let the cold hold you back from getting outdoors. Eddie Bauer's new Evertherm down jacket is unlike any other. No quilting, no cold spots. This is down. Available exclusively at Eddie Bauer stores or at eddiebauer.com/evertherm. Eddie Bauer, live your adventure. It feels like our tech is moving faster and faster every day. The robots are stealing our jobs. Privacy is dead. The internet is ruining the next generation. Now more than ever, it's important to recognize that we need to see where we're going. And in order to see where we're going, it's important to see where we've been. And I am very excited today on Triangulation to talk to Leslie Berlin. She is the author of Troublemakers, the Silicon Valley's coming of age. She is also the project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University. I am honored to talk to you, Leslie.
Likewise. Glad to be here.
So let's start. You've made a career out of studying Silicon Valley history. What fascinates you the most about this area?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've always thought that American history really underplays how important technology has been from the very, very beginning. And when I moved out here, which was a long time ago, it was in 1993, I started looking around and realizing, well, this is where so much that determines our lives happened. And that was 1993. I mean, we didn't really even have a functional web at that point. And so now when you think about all the things that you spend your day doing and how dependent you are on your technology and how terrifying it is if you say lose it, it really drives home how much our everyday lives are infused with Silicon Valley, even for people who don't live here.
I know. I mean, you read that it's only 35 square miles. It's not a very big place. I mean, I think the idea of Silicon Valley is a lot bigger than the actual space. Mm-hmm. Why here? Why there? I mean, why in that space? Why did everything develop there?
Well, a couple things came together at the same time. First, Silicon Valley got really, really lucky that the mom of the guy who invented the transistor lived here. And he wanted to be with his mom. His name is William Shockley. He wanted to be with his mother and decided to set up a company here. And the transistor is like a little grain of sand around which the entire Silicon Valley pearl has grown. It's just been layer after layer. And when you look at what came out of the valley and continues to, it's so much of it can be traced back to that transistor. It's like the littlest doll in one of those Russian nesting doll sets. And so the technology was key. That was just plain old luck. Timing was super important as well, because that transistor makes its way here in 1956. And at that point, there really isn't an industrial economy here. It's pretty much orchards. And with a few companies, Hewlett Packard was here already. But it was the major economy was still fruits and canning fruits. And so what happened was you were able to build an entire ecosystem around technology. Gordon Moore, in a different context, told me that one of the great ways to make sure you have a good part of the market is to shoot your arrow and then draw the bullseye around the arrow. And that's sort of what happened in the Valley. The technology landed here, and then the business environment grew up around the technology, kind of perfectly developed for it. And a third thing was that the culture out here was remarkably open. Even back in the 50s and 60s, there was this huge influx of people to Silicon Valley. And of course, that influx continues today with people from all over the world. And by the time you get to the book that I wrote, which is about the 1970s, you have that kind of openness becoming the counterculture and the hippie movement. And so you ended up with a very, very powerful technology in the hands of free thinkers. And that is what really kicked things off.
So your last book was the biography of Robert Noyce, the man behind the microchip, and that was really the 60s. And then this is kind of like the sequel to that, but it's not just about one man. It's many different, seven different men and women. Why did you choose these certain people to write about in the book?
Yeah, so Bob Noyce, more than most people in the world, actually deserves the title of a great man who deserves great man history. And he absolutely, I'm so thrilled I wrote a biography about him. And as I was writing that book, even then I started to realize, well, there's so many people around him who are doing incredible things that are contributing to his success. And I really wanted to write about an array of people from a number of different industries and backgrounds. So my criteria were the people had to tell us something important about Silicon Valley. So I have one person in the book is a woman named Fawn Alvarez, who starts out picking fruit in the orchards, ends up working on a manufacturing line, and eventually makes the jump into the job of chief of staff for the president of IBM Rome. And she was just a wonderful way of talking about how there used to be factories in Silicon Valley. She's an example of what I mean about something tells us important about the Valley. The second thing was I really wanted people who were somewhat unknown, because we've all read again and again about the same people. So, for example, when I tell the story of Apple, I tell the story of a man named Mike Markla. And a lot of people, of course, know the story of Woz and Jobs in the garage. But Mike Markla is the guy who he owned a third of Apple along with Woz and Jobs. And he's the person who was able to see the incredible genius of those two fellows and the computer that they had built together, and to turn that idea into a company. I mean, Steve Jobs was 21 at that time. He'd had 17 months of work experience in his entire life, and that was as a tech for Atari. So it was really Mike who brought in the people who turned that into a company, people he had worked with in the chip industry, because he had worked at Fairchild and at Intel. So they had to tell us something important. They had to be unknown. And the third thing is that their lives had to be interesting. I really believe that as important as technology is, what really makes it come alive are the stories of the people behind it. And that's what I wanted to do in this book, was find people like, for example, Al Alcorn is someone I write about. He's the guy who developed Pong, the engineer, and was just key for the company Atari that really kind of kicked off video games, another industry that was born during this time. Well, Al Alcorn, when the book opens, is a hippie on the streets of Berkeley, and watching as protesters are being clubbed over the head by the police in protests. And his evolution from a guy who is kind of used to being on the sidelines and needs to be told, okay, now you should do this, now you should do that, into this really brilliant independent thinker is the kind of narrative arc that I thought would interest a lot of people, and certainly interested me.
Yeah, the Markkula part was really interesting because as much as I talk about Apple, as much as I love my iPhone and my Mac, like when I started to read the Markkula part, I realized like I hadn't really thought of him since Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs, and which I listened to, I didn't read, and like I just kept hearing the person who read the biography like his name, and I was like, oh, I've totally forgotten about him. And even that book doesn't give Markkula the attention that I think he really deserves. You write about his thoughts about empathy, which I think was fascinating to me, especially now if you think about what's going on with Silicon Valley now. But you said that he said if we have empathy for our customers and dealers, we will truly understand their needs better than any other company. That was part of his market. He was the marketing guy, like maybe one of the first real marketing guys. Do you think that has really changed with Apple or with other companies in Silicon Valley?
Well, I think that this notion that we really have to understand the customers is at the core of any successful business, actually, whether it's in Silicon Valley or elsewhere. I think that trying to kind of seamlessly integrate your product into your customers' lives is, you know, one of the secrets to success. What Mike did, I think, that's especially important is that he understood from the beginning how invaluable that sort of moment of excitement and wonder when you think a product is truly beautiful. That was one of Mike's really important contributions to Apple. And of course, it's something that Steve Jobs later perfected. Interestingly, for Mike, the sort of things that really got him excited were things like the circuit boards. He was an engineer's engineer, so he was willing to spend enormous amounts of money on the outside, on things that people saw, so like Apple's marketing materials and their original booths and such for trade shows were the highest quality, even though the company was teensy tiny. But he also really, really cared about what was going on inside those machines as well.
Yeah, he's fascinating. I mean, you also write like just the tidbits about how he was the one that was like telling Steve Jobs to put his shoes on in a meeting because, you know, he'd been in enough boardrooms to know that you need to wear your shoes. It's like how such a colorful character could have like slipped through. And I'm sure, you know, people like you or other real historians won't say, well, we all know him. He hasn't really slipped through. But you talk about Fawn Alvarez, too. She was one of my favorite characters. I call them characters. They're obviously all real people.
Right.
She reminded me of some of the characters in Hidden Figures, the book. Like she's sort of like the Hidden Figures of tech. Can you tell us a little bit more about her?
So Fawn is the woman I was talking about who started out as a small child picking fruit and then moved to the manufacturing line. And she didn't graduate from, as a matter of fact, she never started college. And her mother, who also worked on the manufacturing lines in Silicon Valley, had not gone beyond 10th grade. And yet through sort of sheer moxie, these women were able to move, first of all, to running these production lines, and then on into professional white-collar positions. And it's really important to understand that on top of all of the characteristics and traits that they brought to their experience, they were working in Silicon Valley at companies at a time where the manufacturing workers were treated extremely well, so that the benefits that were given to engineers and high-level employees in the sort of professional suites were also almost all of them passed all the way through the company. So they were at a company called Rolm, and at Rolm, after 6 years of work, you got 12 weeks of fully paid vacation. And that was whether you were the CEO or whether you worked on the manufacturing line. And consequently, these women were able to buy stock at reduced rates and end up actually owning houses and really leading very solid middle-class lives from factory work. And now it's almost impossible to imagine that there would be factories in Silicon Valley, because now Silicon Valley is all about software.
Is it also impossible? I mean, you live there. Is it also impossible to really realize, to see that same kind of growth, the same ability? I mean, there's still, there are still lots of farms and lots of farm workers, people. There's lots of fruit to still pick. Is there, do you see anything like that going on in the valley now, that sort of jump from that, like Fon Alvarez did?
I think what it's interesting, I was just on a panel yesterday with the engineering lead at Reddit, and he was talking about how he really thinks that Valley companies need to be paying a lot more attention to things like coding boot camps, that so much of the work in the Valley doesn't require a four-year CS degree. And as a matter of fact, it's changing so quickly all the time that, you know, sort of 6 months later, you need to be able to switch and be learning something new anyway. So I think that smart companies are going to realize that good people come from a diverse range of backgrounds and environments, and that that you can train smart people to do the work that you need done.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've seen that a lot in like coal country too. Like there's a lot of people going in there, setting up coding boot camps, giving people jobs and showing them that they can do this kind of work. So you spent 6 years on the book, which is, a millennia in Silicon Valley time. I mean, what are some of the biggest changes over the 6 years since you started it? Obviously, that you've been, working in as a historian for longer than that. But since you started the book, were there big changes that informed your writing of it that are taking place in Silicon Valley now?
I think the biggest change, that's actually a really interesting question. I think the biggest change is the way that Silicon Valley is perceived. So that actually for my entire career working on Silicon Valley history, Silicon Valley has been the sort of golden child of the golden state, the place that was the greatest promise for the American economy and for our futures. And I would say, maybe since the election, maybe a little longer than that, there's been a real flip, and there's been all this concern around, and I would say rightfully so, concern around, are these companies too big? What do they know about us? Is our information safe? Are we being manipulated? Are these companies run by people who we want to have such influence over our lives? That has been a really, really big change.
And now, does that surprise you that being from the area and steeped in this history, does it surprise you that people are in general starting to question these things, or have you been questioning them and wondering why it took people so long?
I've probably been drinking the Kool-Aid along with everybody else. I actually think that the vast majority of people at these companies are very, very well-intentioned, and that these companies, in some sense, this is something that happens again and again in Silicon Valley. Someone has an idea and they just start working on it, and then the next thing they know, it's enormous. So, you have eight guys who quit their job in 1957 because they can't stand their boss, that same William Shockley I was talking about, who brought the transistor to the Valley. And within 15 years, they're able to make a credible argument that if the federal government doesn't support the chip industry, the entire U.S. economy is at risk. And that wasn't planned. And that's, I think, what you're seeing with a lot of these companies is, someone starts a little network in their dorm room to be able to say whether someone's hot or not. And the next thing you know, billions of people are on this network. And I mean, the other thing that I want to be sure to point out is that Silicon Valley is much, much more than just these big companies that you hear about. I think that gets lost sometimes in all the attention that is being paid to the bigger companies. And the one other thing I wanted to say is that while this particular form of criticism I do feel is unprecedented, people have been saying for a long time, oh, Silicon Valley's on its last legs, whether it's going to be the oil crisis and, in the 70s or Japanese competition in the 80s, or it's going to be that Y2K is going to kill the Valley, or China and India are going to kill the Valley, or it's, the dot-com bust is going to kill the Valley. So it's always been this question of, well, will it survive? Will it survive? And I continue to think it will survive unless we shut down the immigration nozzle, at which point I think that Silicon Valley would be at real risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because it's hard. The government involvement, I mean, that's the thing. Like, a lot of people say, like, oh, well, Silicon Valley wants to, you know, stay out of government. They've always wanted to stay out of government. But reading your book, I really realized, like, that's not really true. Like, that's kind of a myth. There's always been a lot of involvement, you know, weaving in and out of Silicon Valley. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the government has been a huge player out here. So you've had this interesting combination of the countercultural, you can't make me do it, sock it to the man sort of philosophy pervading the valley on the one hand. And on the other hand, the government itself has been a hugely important player. So when the microchip is invented, 100% of those purchases are made by the federal government, specifically the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is who starts the ARPANET, which is what morphs into the internet as we know it. The changes in legislation that Silicon Valley companies really fought for, and this same time period that I'm writing about is when Silicon Valley companies start to join forces and lobby in Washington, that they got legislation passed that, for example, made it possible for pension funds to invest in venture capital companies, and all of a sudden that you have a huge growth in the amount of money that's available to these companies, to the venture funds. Legislation that you don't really even think about, or something like the breakup of AT&T in the early 80s. This, and even today, in a lot of ways, we've seen this real sort of revolving door between Washington and Silicon Valley, and that has served Silicon Valley well. So the notion that this all happened independent of the government is just not true, especially also, you know, the things that we take for granted. The way I think of it is a company starting in the United States, actually anywhere, is starting on third base relative to the rest of the world. We generally don't have problems with bribery. We have clean water. We have a rule of law. We have things that we just so take for granted that we don't think of them at all. But they are out there. They're the foundation on which everything is built.
So you said that that Silicon Valley is so much bigger than just these big companies we think about, and I want to get to that. But what about like Amazon and Microsoft and, you know, other big companies that I can't think of besides Amazon and Microsoft that aren't in Silicon Valley?
Right.
I mean, you know, a lot of people just lump them into it too. Like, what do you think about those companies?
Well, I mean, I think that when you said earlier, people think of Silicon Valley as, you know, much more than the strip of peninsula that it geographically is defined by the term. You're absolutely right, and I'd point out that's another West Coast center of industry, and I think that the Seattle ecosystem is a lot like Silicon Valley's, and it attracts many of the same types of people. And as a matter of fact, you see that circulation happening all the time too, from Seattle to the Valley, back to Seattle.
And so, what about the rest, the other companies we don't think about? What's important about those? That what do you think people need to know more about besides the big companies we think about in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one thing that we need to think about is that there's so much opportunity that the move to software has really made possible to people, not just in the Valley, but all over the world. So that if you have a laptop and an internet connection, you are able to join, you know, the tech business, and that's amazing. And I think that people need to understand that when we talk about big, bad Silicon Valley, what we're actually talking about is very small companies as well.
Yeah, and I think people lump San Francisco in there a lot too, especially when you're talking about big and bad. You know, just if you know, anyone who lived in San Francisco before, you know, it's never been the same. And I mean, I lived there in 2000, like during the dot-com crash. And, you know, like you said, everyone thought it was going to be over and it rose from the ashes and probably will again. I want to talk about money, about venture capital, because it's not the same as it is now. Didn't start out, especially the people involved in venture capital. They're not the same kind of people that we think of now involved in venture capital. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the time that I'm talking about in the book is really when you see institutionalized venture capital start to take off, and the people who are involved in it are almost exclusively people who were not professional investors. They were people who had worked in these companies, in these industries, in operating roles. So if you look at the founders of Kleiner Perkins, for example, Eugene Kleiner was one of the famous Fairchild Eight, the eight who started Fairchild Semiconductor. And Tom Perkins worked at HP. Or if you look at the birth of Sequoia Capital, that was Don Valentine, who had worked at Fairchild and at National. And the venture capitalists at that time could really bring not just money to the table, but their own experience as well as the links to pretty much any type of a supplier or any sort of resource that a small company would need.
Well, I want to talk more about ethics in Silicon Valley and how those changed over time or maybe haven't changed so much. But first, I want to take a break and thank one of our sponsors. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. Whether you are in the market for a mortgage now or you plan to get a mortgage in the future, you should check out Rocket Mortgage. They make the process a lot easier because the mortgage process, it was not keeping up with the times. It was pretty dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution. There was a problem, and Quicken Loans threw technology at it, and they came up with Rocket Mortgage, and it's great. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's really simple, so you can understand everything. Part of the problem with getting a mortgage, it's so much money. It's the most expensive thing you'll ever buy, hopefully, and it can get confusing, but Rocket Mortgage helps you be confident that you're getting the right mortgage that's designed just for you. It's also convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at just the touch of a button. It's also pretty powerful, so if you're looking to buy your first home or maybe your 10th home, Rocket Mortgage can perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. Based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of your home loan options, all of the ones that you qualify for, and then find the one that is just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Triangulation. Welcome back. I am talking to Leslie Berlin, who wrote this amazing history of Silicon Valley. At a certain time, Silicon Valley's coming of age, troublemakers. And I want to talk about ethics. We've talked a little bit already about how maybe this hasn't sort of changed, or we haven't talked so much about it in Silicon Valley or about the ethics of Silicon Valley until the election. But You write about, like, Atari, for example, and reading about Nolan Bushnell, who, you know, I have a special place in my heart for. I had no idea there were, like, naked hot tub parties and, you know, just crazy, like, Uber-like stuff. So I started to think of them more of a Travis Kalanick type. What was going on and what happened? The story of Atari is crazy. Tell us a little bit about Nolan Bushnell. I know you interviewed him for the book.
I did. I think it's safe to still keep Nolan in a special place in your heart. What was going on at Atari really reflected in some ways what was going on all over the United States. I mean, there were, in fact, you know, naked hot tub parties. There were also, I mean, one time the venture capitalists showed up and Nolan insisted that they meet while he was in the hot tub. and it was sort of a, who's going to come in and join me? And there were, I mean, Atari was a crazy, crazy place. People would literally talk about getting a contact high walking down. Again, it was a manufacturing line. You know, they were building these machines. At the same time, there was really serious engineering going on there as well. So I think it's important to kind of have that understanding when you think about Atari. I think, too, that it was really surprising to me to see what today it would just be such unacceptable behavior towards women. You saw it at Atari, but you saw it everywhere. The stories that I was told would just, you know, curl your toes. But the, you know, in the company newsletter at Atari, they published a short story that was, you know, mildly pornographic about, all I'll tell you is that it was about a Swedish breastologist named Dr. Wolfgang Tittleboob. I mean, this is in the Atari. Can you imagine in the corporate newsletter?
It's true. Like, we need to be reminded that it was a different time then, but it was also, in some ways, it was a better time for some women, right? I mean, there is this idea that, I wasn't there, but there's this idea that, like, maybe around the, like, things were going well for women in Silicon Valley until maybe, like, around the 90s, like, until you got there, Leslie.
Yeah, exactly. It was all me.
And then things started to sort of go downhill after that. I mean, you hear of, like, all the women that went to Stanford and graduated, like, with the PayPal mafia and, you know, Elon Musk, or, you know, who, all those people that graduated with them. And, you know, you hear about all the men, but then where are all the women that graduated from Stanford in the mid-90s? Can you talk a little bit about ways in which, I mean, we also already talked about Fawn Alvarez, and things were pretty good for her being able to, you know, work her way up that way. But she was treated kind of poorly, and despite that. So was it in any way better for women back then than it might be now?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, on the one hand, in some weird way, what we see as completely appalling behavior, they just accepted as par for the course. So, of mm-hmm. course, it wasn't better, but it also was just seen as normal that someone, you're the CEO of a company, like Sandy Kurtzig is another person I profile. She's the first woman to take a tech company public, and she has a software company, and people think she's a booth babe. And she goes to meetings and people ask her to get the coffee. And she, software was so unusual at the time that even Larry Ellison, who went to try to fund Oracle with his co-founders, the venture capitalist just laughed him out of the office. And he likes to say that the secretaries would check in his briefcase to make sure he hadn't stolen a copy of Business Week, you know, on his way out. He seemed so shady. And Sandy was sort of doubly an outsider, being a woman, being in software. And when she said she sold software, people thought that she sold lingerie.
So, I mean, a lot of what was going on, a lot of what computers were doing was, you know, they were doing women's work. So, I mean, secretarial work. So you think that had any influence on why this was maybe not the best environment for women? Or do you think this was the way it was in all industries at this time?
Well, it's the way it was in all industries all the time. And at the same time, the women who did manage to break through were generally accepted as equals. I mean, first of all, in the manufacturing line, it was all women. So that wasn't really an issue. But in, you know, you look, there were important women on the Macintosh team at Apple. There were important women game designers at Atari. And they were seen as just part of the team. There wasn't anything going on that seemed particularly discriminatory towards them. Something that you point out, though, I'm glad you brought this up. I mean, one of the things that really surprised me was I tell the story of a guy named Bob Taylor. Bob Taylor is an incredible incredible person who almost no one's heard of. He is the person who convinced the Department of Defense to start that ARPANET that morphed into the internet. Then he's the person who at Xerox PARC ran the lab that gave us pretty much everything when you think of your computer today, when you think about the Windows and the graphical user interface and the mouse and being networked together and being able to print to a printer and what you see on your screen is what gets printed out. That was a lab that this same guy, Bob Taylor, who started the ARPANET, also ran that lab. And incidentally, it's that lab that Steve Jobs came to in 1979 and found the ideas that really helped to make the Macintosh breakthrough. And as a third act, then Bob Taylor went and started a research lab at DEC. And one of the things they did was develop the first really, really great search engine, you know, 6 years before Google was started. But anyway, that lab at Xerox PARC actually had what today we would call a personal computer, and it wasn't ever followed up by Xerox itself. And one reason I learned sort of in talking to people there was that you had to type to use a computer, and today everyone types. Back then, only women typed, only secretaries typed, and when they did this beautiful demonstration, actually we're almost exactly on the 40th anniversary of that demonstration today. The Xerox execs were standing around after, sort of, someone overheard one of these execs saying to the other, "Wow, well, what'd you think of that?" Exhibit, you know, what did you think of that? And he said, mind you, this is the first time anyone had seen, any of those guys at least, had seen effectively a personal computer. And his response was, "I've never seen a man type that fast." So they wouldn't touch it. Afterwards, there was sort of an interactive time where you could play with the technology. And the men were all standing around with their arms crossed, and their wives were all on the computers using them. And instead of that being sort of evidence that these are machines that are beautifully designed with the user interface so sophisticated that you can almost intuitively understand how to use them, well, that was seen as further evidence that these weren't really particularly valuable. I mean, they were, you know, there were women using them.
Oh, yeah. I remember clearly, like, when I first moved to San Francisco in 98, 20 years ago, and I did temp jobs, and none of the bosses, they didn't have a computer in their office still. And that was, you know, the computers existed then. But, you know, your job sometimes as, like, the secretary or the temp assistant was to read their email for them because they couldn't do it.
Or type it. They dictate to you, and then you would type it up, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, it is amazing. So back to the ethics, I think a lot of what people are complaining now about Silicon Valley is that sort of Facebook move fast and break things motto. And like, okay, well, then now you've broken things and what are you going to do about it? Has that always really been, I mean, was that, you know, did Mark Zuckerberg model that after his predecessors, the people that you write about?
So I don't know what Mark Zuckerberg, you know, chose for his model, but I can tell you that this whole notion of disruption for the sake of disruption is it wasn't really part of the ethos at the time. There, it was what I think of as rebellion with a purpose. Like, there was an actual idea that you were going to build something better. You know, it wasn't simply let's blow these things up. And I think, just for the record, you know, Facebook abandoned the break things part of that statement a long, long time ago. I mean, I think even officially. But I think that you're pointing to something really important, which gets back to this notion of these companies, these ideas growing so, so, so fast. And, you know, I opened the book. It's funny because my first book, I opened with a quote from Schopenhauer, and this book I open with a quote from Raiders of the Lost Ark. So I'm afraid my brain's deteriorating. But it's a scene between Indiana Jones and Sala, and Indy says, you know, I'm going after that truck. And Sala says, well, what are you going to do? And Indy says, I don't know. I'm making it up as I go. And I think that that really has been something that's happened in the Valley for a really long time. And I just want to say that it's really incumbent upon us to help figure out, okay, well, what is it that this next step is going to be? You know, it's, we are users of these technologies, right? We're the people who are deciding that we're going to give up information about ourselves so we can get, you know, free 10th coffee with our purchase. And, you know, we are making decisions about what apps to use depending on personal convenience without necessarily thinking through some of these questions. And I do think that we have not just the opportunity, but the responsibility to make sure that when people are needing to make things up, because again, I don't think there's been deliberate malfeasance here. I think things have just grown really big, really fast. And the Silicon Valley's never played on this scale before. We've never been so intimately intertwined in people's lives. So now's the time for us to be asking these sorts of questions and pointing in the direction that we need this technology to evolve, because it's going to continue to evolve. So now's the time to start putting some guardrails around it and make sure that we're all in agreement as to where we want things to go, understanding that that may end up costing us something in terms of convenience or price. And we just need to decide, is that a trade-off we're willing to make or not?
Yeah, I mean, how is it going to work? I mean, I feel like that's the question I ask every day. Like, how are we going to rein in Facebook? I mean, there is, to some extent, you're absolutely right that we, you know, it's incumbent on us to say, like, is this privacy versus convenience? You know, is that a good trade-off? But then, you know, Facebook has gone so far as, you know, my husband doesn't have a Facebook account. He's not, he never has, but there's still, like, if you look into the research of how it works, because everyone's giving up their own contacts, you know, if he's even had his contacts in anyone's phone, like, they, Facebook has a record. And you're right, there's no deliberate malfeasance, but, like, they are, you know, he didn't do anything except for give, you know, something, somebody he sold something on Craigslist his phone number to or something in order to get this. So it does feel a little bit like out of our hands. Like, as a historian, is there, I know you say this is the first time it's been so involved in, you know, our life, but having looked into this history, is there anything you can you solve this problem for us, Leslie?
Yes. I'm so glad you asked. I've actually wondered what would happen if we insisted on something like has been imposed upon credit card companies. It used to be that all of the credit card statement, like, legalese was, you know, in that fine print at the bottom. Something changed, and now you have to actually have in that upper right corner a very straightforward statement in big type saying, pay your bill or else you're going to accrue interest and this is how much you're going to owe next month. And I've wondered what would happen if our terms of service were required to be reduced down to something, you know, that simple. And what would happen if, you know, being part of the problem is that we don't know, it's the old unknown unknowns. So some sort of requirements around transparency of what is being collected. I don't necessarily know if reining in is the right metaphor to be using, but I think the notion of making informed sort of setting informed limits, I think, is the way I would describe it.
Oh yeah, I would like to see that. I mean, the legalese just keeps, it seems like it just keeps getting bigger and bigger as we go on.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about where we are today and how you can solve all our problems. But first, I want to take a minute to thank one of our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by eddiebauer.com/evertherm. Let me show you an Evertherm. Here's an Evertherm. This is an Evertherm. It's getting cold out there here. If you're on the other side of the world, it's probably getting warm. So you'll have to think about this for later. But you can hear it crinkling if you're listening. That's the softness. It's so soft. I love Eddie Bauer clothes. I have several flannels, but let me tell you about Evertherm, because this is a tech show and there's a lot of tech involved in the Evertherm. There are no cold spots. It's powered by thin down insulation, down fabric, not loose down clusters. There's no migration, none of that nasty balling up that you've got in your previous down jackets you might have bought. So whether it's snow kiting in Minnesota or ice climbing in Colorado, maybe you're going on a snowshoe trip, be sure to wear Eddie Bauer's new Evertherm down jacket. There's no quilting. No big. It's not big and bulky. You won't look like a snowman. It's stylish, too. It holds heat better than traditional down. Warm down to negative 15 degrees. It's slim profile, and it's ultra light, so it's great for packing. You can just shove it in a bag. It doesn't take up much space at all. And also, you can move around with it. Great arm mobility, and it's wind resistant. It includes water-resistant storm repel DWR technology. I told you there was tech in this jacket. It's available for both men and women. And it's also been tested by Eddie Bauer's world-class guides. It was tested in Mount Everest, on Mount Kilimanjaro, and in the Grand Tetons. And it was tested at my desk here at the Twit Studios, which sometimes gets very cold, and it was very warm. And all Eddie Bauer products, of course, are guaranteed for life. Live your adventure with a new Evertherm down jacket from Eddie Bauer, available exclusively at Eddie Bauer stores, or you can also find it online, of course, at eddiebauer.com/Evertherm. That's eddiebauer.com/Evertherm. And we thank Eddie Bauer for their support of Triangulation. So I'm a big fan of Kara Swisher, who's been covering, Silicon Valley and in San Francisco and tech for so long. And she did an interview recently with Erica Joy Baker, who she has worked for Google. She famously posted a spreadsheet, public Google spreadsheet where people could, you know, write their salaries on to just create more transparency. And Kara affectionately called Erica a troublemaker, which, you know, I just listened to this interview and I was thinking, like, is that the kind of troublemakers that you see today? Like people just really like disrupting, as you said, but for a purpose?
Yeah, I think that I'm so glad you told me that story. I'd heard about this, but I didn't know her name. Yes, that's exactly what I see as very purposeful troublemaking. And the other thing, and it's interesting that I didn't know her name, is that I think for so many of these troublemakers, they don't need the glory. Mike Markle, who we talked about earlier, he was so self-effacing that when he wrote software, he did it under a pseudonym, you know, which was Johnny Appleseed. And I think that we have today a lot of people who are pushing for change, and they're doing it very quietly. And I think that's great too, and a hallmark of this sort of person who makes a difference. And I think too that something that's really important to understand that I don't think we've talked about here is teamwork and how important that's been in the Valley and how that continues to be so important. Because I think we think about innovation and entrepreneurship, and very often sort of a single individual rises to the surface. But I really think that innovation is much more like a baseball game, and one in which a pitcher throws a perfect game. And anyone who watched the game knows, oh, good night. You know, the first baseman killed himself stepping on the bag, and the outfielder made these incredible catches, and the catcher called exactly the right throw for every single batter. But the only thing that goes into the history books is that the pitcher threw a perfect game. And I think that's our model for innovation in a lot of people's minds. And it's one thing that I really hope that we can do is change that model a little bit. Bob Taylor, who I was telling you is the guy at ARPA and then at Xerox PARC, he liked to say that none of us is as smart as all of us. And I think that is a very good motto for Silicon Valley in actually a lot of ways.
Yeah, you also talk about how he always wanted an award for group creativity, like some kind of recognition of how much went into those products.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he always thought that a whole lab should get tenure, you know, not just the one lead researcher.
So as a historian, I mean, do you think, because it is true, like the people that you write about, they could have made more of a name for themselves. But I mean, these days, everybody can make a name for themselves. I mean, mm-hmm. Erica Baker, like if you hear her talk about her coming clean about this, you know, the salary and how she was treated at Google, like it was just a Medium post. And she just thought, okay, well, I want to share this with my friends. And she had no idea it was going to go viral. And so it does seem like there's so much more because one of the many great things about the internet. I mean, we've talked about some of the dangerous things, but of course, you know, you and I believe in technology. We love it. There's some sort of, you know, FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, of course.
Right.
But there's some great things, and that is getting these voices heard. So as a historian, do you, I mean, you had to dig deep for the information in this book, but and there wasn't as much to go through. Like, do you ever look at like the way Twitter, the fast, you know, the speed at which Twitter moves, or, you know, tech news, or just, you know, everything, and think like, oh, how am I going to be able to write my next book when there's so much more information?
Yeah, it's actually a huge, huge problem. And as you said, I work at Stanford, and I work in the Silicon Valley archives in our library system at Stanford. And there's a huge team at Stanford that is teamed up with some other universities and also with the Library of Congress trying to address exactly this question. This is called Born Digital Data. And it's sort of like, well, how are we going to capture this? And then once we have it, how the heck is it going to be readable in, you know, 10 years, much less 100 years, much less 300 years. I mean, paper is an incredibly stable medium, you know. So these are really, really big questions that, and also just imagine that someone could get a hold, with your permission, obviously. Imagine you gave all of your emails at some point at the end of your career. Well, how on earth would anyone even begin to look through those, you know? And how could you, as a researcher, make sure that private material is kept separate? And I mean, this is another thing where Stanford's completely on the leading edge. They've developed a software program called EPAD that's now being used in many places. And so trying to stay ahead of this, I mean, it's interesting. You're trying to stay ahead so that future people looking back can see what happened.
Are there physical archives there that, like, are there things people can touch from this time period?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I used so much of them. I mean, I was able to look at and hold Atari's business plans, and they were going to do an IPO, but they decided not to, but they put together a red herring. I mean, we have the original computer mice, so many versions of what the computer mouse looked like. It's, you know, there are all these, we have the biggest collection of Apple materials anywhere in the world. It's incredible. It's like a time machine. You know, it feels like one of those portals in Harry Potter where you touch one of these things and it's like zoom, you know, you've gone through you're in the flu system, and all of a sudden now you've been spat out into whatever time period it was, and it's truly magical.
So does someone, like, does someone have an iPhone 10 that they've like put away, like, this is for the archives for the future?
There are a lot of places that do that, yeah, that are keeping the hardware. And that's, you know, that's a really important component as well. I mean, again, you want to make sure that they're going to be able to work, right? Mm-hmm. My favorite stuff is where you're just, you know, oh, here's Bob Noyce's letter home asking for can someone loan him some money so he can try to start, you know, Fairchild, or just those things where it's so easy. You only hear about the entrepreneurs, the successful ones, once they're successful. And to kind of go back and be able to see, oh, here, like, one of the things we have at Stanford is a note that someone, a printer, you know, someone who just ran a printing service, a note that he wrote for one of his colleagues after he first visited Jobs and Wozniak in the garage. And he's describing, oh, there are these two punks and they're thinking they're going to build a computer. And he ends it, sounds fishy, watch out, you know. And I mean, you're just there. It's just great.
Oh, that's amazing. And I mean, there's great photos in your book as well. My favorite is you next to the Facebook sign, which on the back is the Sun Microsystems sign. That's right. It's a sun sign.
That's right. Yeah, got it.
Which is just amazing. Like, you know, they obviously could make a new sign, but they just keep it there.
It's a deliberate decision, actually. I mean, this book is super deeply researched, so I had to figure out a way to get a hold of Facebook and ask them why that was left that way, because I'd heard rumors that it was a deliberate reminder for Facebook employees as they leave the campus. They see the sign of a company that disappeared that had been on the top of the world. I mean, Sun Microsystems at some point very seriously considered buying Apple. And that sign Mark Zuckerberg left in the way he did as a deliberate reminder that you can't take any of this for granted.
Well, Leslie, we've run out of time. I know you have an event to go to. I have so many more questions, but you'll have to read the book to find out why what happened to Atari, whether the naked hot tub parties were their downfall or not. So much amazing stuff in this book. Leslie Berlin is the project historian at the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford, the author of Troublemakers, Silicon Valley's Coming of Age, and, of course, his prequel about Robert Noyce, his biography. And I can't wait to see what you write next. You can find the book at troublemakersbook.com or anywhere you can buy books. And Leslie is also on Twitter at, is it Leslie Berlin SV?
Yes, that's me.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on, Leslie.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us on Triangulation. Triangulation records live every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific and other times if you're in another time zone. And you can always get it on demand. You can subscribe to it. We would love it if you subscribe. You can go to twit.tv/try and subscribe to our show and see all the old episodes there as well. And also, we are doing our end of the year best of episodes. So if there was a favorite interview that you saw, a favorite moment in one of the interviews, head over to twit.tv/best of and tell us the best of shows, your favorite Triangulation, or any show. I am Megan Maroney. I'm Megan Maroney on Twitter, and I host iOS Today every Tuesday and Tech News Weekly every Thursday. And thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.